The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
All right. So this weekend's reading was Matt Deacock giving a YouTube presentation. Actually, it was a Google presentation that was recorded onto YouTube. And he's the designer of Pandemic. He also made a game, Forbidden Island. And I think he also did Desert. I'm assuming that he did Forbidden Desert.
Okay.
That's my guess, because they're not that different games to begin with. I mean, these are cooperative games for the most part. How many of you played one of these games? Forbidden Island, Pandemic, Pandemic, a board game specifically. Yeah, okay, yeah. Because Pandemic, the computer game, is completely different game.
Pandemic.
See, huh?
No, Pandemic 2,
the
online game, or?
Yeah, the one where you shut off Madagascar.
Yeah.
Okay. That one is a different game, yeah. It's same title, same concept, right? I mean, it sort of makes sense that they will have the game in themselves. I mean, that's probably more of a similarity of Civilization, the board game, and Civilization, the computer game. Although, the Civilization that you play as a board game nowadays was not the same Civilization, the board game that existed when the computer game came out.
Yeah,
that's
the idea of the tech tree.
Yeah, the tech tree was the big thing.
Yeah.
The big difference. Just the computer game aside, if you played it, how many of you basically played a game where it just turned into one person telling you to do everything? That's my games of Pandemic. Okay. How many of you had the same thing happen with like either Forbidden Island or Forbidden Desert? Huh? It happened to you too? Yeah. Oh, were you the one telling people? Oh, yeah. So it seems. How many people played Forbidden Island? Or Desert? Okay, only one. Okay, so
100%.
So maybe it happens a lot more often. I don't know. I find it happens a little bit less often with Island, but it happens to be every time I play Pandemic. And on one hand, I'm usually the one receiving openers, and I don't mind because I'm not that invested in it. But on the other hand, I'm not that invested in it. It kind of like takes me out. When someone starts telling me, this is what you should do, clearly this is the optimal move, this is the thing that you should do, and it's like, that's fine, I'll do it. I don't care about this game anymore because I don't have any decisions I need to make. But I don't know. Yeah.
So in my experience, it's always been each of the players is good at taking the
Everybody else is telling you to do something?
So every single person is telling every single other person exactly what to do. Every person ends up making a decision for themselves just at the end, being like, okay guys, here's what I'm actually doing because I think that I'm doing the right thing.
That sounds reasonably interactive and you still have a decision to make anyway.
It's fun because you actually get to like, the people like actually listen.
Yeah.
On one hand, because you when you bring up a good point, they'll be like, oh yeah, that's a good point. But on the other hand, like, no one's... It's not one person playing the game.
Yeah. It's like a board of directors giving you advice, and then you got to figure out what's the right thing to do, right?
Except as soon as you're done, you start giving advice.
Yeah, and everyone's fifth rolls.
I don't know if this... I don't know if you're saying it's a negative necessarily.
I don't necessarily say that.
But I feel like that might have very well been what he was going for. Because like in the video, we talked a lot about his wife, and like he wanted to be able to play with his wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of a serious gamer can play with someone that's not as invested, which is kind of what you're saying a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, as a result, I've played many games of Pandemic, you know, which is a good thing. Yeah.
So I was going to say, Settings in a sentence always by like having a hidden trader mechanic though, where if you're hidden trader, then like you obviously can't just do that when everyone else says that would be like a trader.
Right. Like deliberately sabotaging.
Yeah. Also, there's a game that I've heard is actually just like being play tested basically, called Beneath the Darkness, and it's like a really, it's a pretty tactical there's like Assassin of One, you have strategic components and you have teams of players there. But there's huge, like, there are large players in depth, but at the same time, it's really hard for like one player to go help someone else on their team and do everything else for someone else on their team because it's a time component of 2 minutes for your turn. And so it happens a lot that an unlink where like someone is, where like someone swoops in and tries to like help someone else, and they end up screwing it else up even worse because they had no, because they like didn't realize the details of everything that was going on and didn't have the time to analyze it properly.
I think the second example of what you're describing is relevant here. In the realm of like pure co-op games or games with a very strong cooperative component, you've got, you know, there is an assumption, at least in games like Pandemic, that it's not so much that something is out there strategizing to beat you, you know, and you're trying to overcome it, like a different player, for instance, who's trying to achieve victory at your cost. It's more about, can you get your affairs and your communication and your decision making lined up, and a bit of luck, of course, so that you can actually overcome the odds that the designer has set up for you. Whereas I think in the case of the trader style games, there's actually somebody out there who's actively playing the game, who's actively trying to win at your at the expense of your victory. One way that I've certainly seen is the time limit, right? It's okay, you can cooperate as much as you want in a minute, you know, and that just leads to like confusion and bad judgment calls and sometimes hilarity. If you I'm going back to Space Alert, which is maybe a game we should bring out on the last week, because it's for those people who don't remember me describing it in previous class. Classes. You're all members of a starship. You all pretty much aren't sure what you're supposed to be doing. You've all you're playing the game in real time because events happen as you play an audio track that just runs nonstop. It never pauses until the game is over. And you all have to be very, very coordinated to get anything done. You know, just like firing a single gun requires you to charge up that gun. You know, turning on a shield so that you can block enemy fire, you know, needs to be on at the moment the enemy fire is about to hit you, I think, if I recall that. But then also, it just hits the person.
It's a bit easier than the other, but it's also, because there's so many threats, it is.
Yeah.
It's very easy to, like, accidentally run out of energy or to, like, do things coordinate off by a turn or, like, miss the details. But then, like, one of the funniest things is obviously when someone, like, stroke fires their gun at, like, some threat, but they, like, fired a turn before it appeared by accident.
Yeah.
Which is like fire.
Yeah, because all the guns have a range of a recall, right? They have an effective range. So you're all trying to achieve simultaneous victory. You're all trying to not die in that game, but then because you have so little time to be able to figure out what the right thing is to do, you just mess up. That's not the case, I believe, in Desert Island and Pandemic. You have about as much time as you like to make it a group the decision. But there's clearly an appeal to these sort of like completely cooperative games, where your only opponent is the game system that the designer has really created for you. You can of course set difficulty levels in a lot of these games. You know, if you're learning it for the first time, you play it on kind of an easy setup. And then if you're, once everyone's familiar with all the mechanics of the game, you can sort of crank up the difficulty by starting the game at a more difficult level. But I think, anything else that anyone noticed from his talk about the design of a cooperative game?
Yep. You mentioned, I think it might have been in the video or something else in the red, the rule that you said that you couldn't show anybody else
your hand. Yeah.
Said that was a very important component, even though you could freely talk about what was in there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I didn't understand that.
It's kind of giving you still something to do, right? There's like, because you have information that no one else has until you share it, there's still the thing that you can do, which is share the information that you've got. Even though it's not necessarily information that you probably, in a game like Pandemic, it's not information you want to hide. You want everyone else to know this information. So there's no decision to be made, even though there's an activity to be done. But in a game where time is limited, then yes, then it becomes a decision of, do I want to share this piece of information because it's taking away time from doing something else? I worked on a game with the Education Arcade, which is a research group here based in E15. And a long time ago, we made a game where it was a location-based game. So everyone's walking around with GPS and able smart devices. But everyone's trying to investigate the groundwater contamination, basically. But everyone also was like one of three different classes, and they will get different information based on which class they were. Some of them were like geologists. Some of them were, you know, more. I'm trying to remember what. Some of them were biologists. Some of them were geologists. One of the roles was like construction engineer or something like that. So that you knew things about how things were built, but you didn't necessarily know much about, you know, what sort of animals will be affected by certain kinds of contaminants. And so, again, information that you got was private, but it was the kind of thing that you want to share. Now, in a location-based game, sharing that information becomes tough, because everyone's physically spread out over an area. This was a game that was played over the entire MIT campus. Everyone had walkie-talkies, but the nice thing about walkie-talkies is that only one person can talk at a time, right? You know, otherwise, no one really can make sense of anything. It's still kind of the case with if you try to play the game with cell phones, because you can only talk to one person at a time unless you like set up some crazy network. Even if you try to do text messaging, that's time-consuming, right? So that's one way that you can get people involved and feel like they're contributing, which is just give everybody little fragments of information that they need, and then get them to, and then the game becomes more about how do you go about sharing this information rather than what's the decision you make with the information. Now, for some people, once you've got all the information, there is a decision to be made. And in some cases, it feels like a boardroom where, you know, everyone's got different ideas and trying to encourage you to do it in a certain way. And that's great, because that means everyone has is weighing the pros and cons of every possible outcome. But in some cases, it's just like one person just decides to be the decider and is going to tell everybody else the decisions and then everyone else enacts. Has anyone played like sort of cooperative live action type games? Yeah.
Oh, cooperative live-action type games. I played Caduceus, yeah. There was one where there was like, I mean, yeah, a lot of times, one of the things you do when you're writing the window is to like make sure that like is to give everyone part of the puzzle,
yeah.
And because that will just make people communicate and work together,
yeah.
There.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, so for one of the, like, I remember, for me in particular, there was like sometimes you need to do like a research or something.
Mm-hmm.
And for steps to that, you would need to like go collect some components, which you could like sort of do on your own. You could like gather some resources and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you needed to like successfully when a game was like Hangman or give a Pictionary or something,
right.
Describing a specific word that was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so nice to have this cooperation, the cooperation of like, does someone want to like trying to describe the word like space to someone. And it was also sort of like share a little bit about it. Also is interesting is that oftentimes someone said, oh, does anyone want to like when you were like doing Pictionary trying to describe the word destruction?
Mm-hmm.
Like also people want what people thought about your research after that.
Right, right.
Something
of course, yeah. Yeah. So I think what you're describing is like the live action role playing research mechanics.
Yeah, live action.
But in a lot of live action role playing games, even though you may be cooperating on that one activity, you don't know what the ulterior what the motives of every single person in that room is.
Yeah.
Whereas in some other non-LARP type games, that are played on a live action, say trading simulations, for instance. Often everyone's actually on the same team. Everyone's very, very clearly working towards a common goal, just given different roles. For instance, I spent a couple of years in the army, And we had a lot of live action training simulations where, yeah, everyone's on the same team. And then there are instructors out there trying to make your life difficult, sure, but everybody that you're actually working with is communicating and trying to do the best job that they can towards a common goal. Has anyone gone through anything like a sort of simulated exercise or anything, you know, either an evacuation or, you know, like an emergency evacuation?
Yeah, we all have fire drills.
Oh, fire drills, okay, all right, that's a great example. Yeah. Everybody wants to get out of the building alive, right, without falling over. Sure, that's a great example, yeah.
I took a leadership class last semester that did a lot of, like scenarios that you and your team were, you know, mm-hmm. a team in a company trying to design this product. You had all these challenges. Mm-hmm. It was like primarily intended to be cooperative, but because like the class was being built in multiple groups, and so like, there was also like an element of like competition against the other teams to come up with like the best solution.
Do you compete with the other teams for the? Do you feel like you're in competition with the other teams? While you're making your decisions, or is it really just like right at the end when you present everything?
Mostly right at the end, but there were certain ones where, like, you know, like you had like a shop, and there were like pieces you could get, and while you were waiting in line to get different pieces, like you were kind of like scoping out what all the other groups were doing.
Okay.
And part of it was because like it was the same groups all semester. It kind of like, you know, even if there wasn't any like sense of competition between groups at first, like
right.
because over the entire semester you were like working with the same team,
yeah.
you kind of developed over time.
Yeah, yeah. I've been in similar exercises, mostly in school as well. Yeah.
Could this go as simple as just like playing lava when you're like 3 years old and you can't touch the ground and you get from one end of the room to the other without ever touching the ground, jump from pillow to pillow or something?
Uh-huh. Well, let's see. I guess it is entirely cooperative. I guess it is player versus gravity, pretty much. Right? You know, and yeah, I mean, it depends on whether your goal is to be the last person standing, in which it does become a competitive game.
Sure, but if there's one where you're just trying to get from one side of the room to the other or something like that,
yeah,
and you're working together.
Yeah, yeah. If you're all working together, then I would say that is a purely cooperative game, and the rules are fairly simple. Just don't fall off the pillows, which are unstable. And that's very different from having different roles. Everybody has the same role. Everybody is just put in a situation where they can't accomplish much on their own, but they could do quite a lot if they pull.
I would put my sister, and like we kind of had different roles, right? Because I'm 3 years older than her, when we were 5 years old, I can jump significantly further than her, right?
Okay.
So that kind of put us in different roles there a little bit.
I mean, she also has a lower center of gravity, I'm guessing, then?
Sure.
Yeah.
She can also barely walk.
Okay. So you're playing with your sister. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. I don't actually like a lot of like creativity competitions where they put teams against each other. I understand that it does get people enthusiastic and engaged and adrenaline up and want to be able to do their best, but it discourages a lot of information sharing, which could actually be better for learning in the process. So like when we run game jams, for instance, we like a lot of game jams run by colleges will give out awards. Like they'll quite simply have prizes for people who win maximum applause or something like that. I think we do give like verbal kudos. Have we ever done like joke awards?
No, we've never done any awards. So when we're doing it, the joy and the engagement is being able to share at
yeah.
the end and making sure people share throughout the exercise as well.
And those are usually the shout outs that we give at the
yeah.
end, which is like these are the people who really helped other teams.
Yeah.
And people who were clearly a benefit to more than just their own project. We will do those kinds of shout outs because for learning situations, those are cool. But of course, for competitive situations where you don't expect to have a lot of information sharing, say, a school versus a school competition, right? It could be math, it could be sports, it could be We're working on one right now, which is a space computation, a satellite programming thing. Some of you might have seen emails about that. Where a lot of the schools that are working together are geographically separated. They're like different countries, probably speaking different languages. So that may not be terribly much information sharing to begin with, so and it makes sense that they're going to mostly share information with people that are geographically close to them. So it's okay to sort of put them in competition with each other while expecting they're going to cooperate entirely within their own team. But there is a neat wrinkle to that one, which is when it gets to the final rounds, three schools are put together, and one school is always geographically separated from the other ones. And that's to like give students an experience of what it's like to actually work on a space program, right? Because you are working with different companies which are, you know, writing code to all run on the same machine, and all trying to accomplish different problems. And the problem that they're given is so vast and so difficult that one school, you know, one school could probably do a mediocre job on it, but you need the resources of three schools and all the kids in three schools to be able to solve this particular space problem. So you need to communicate and you need to share. And that's an interesting phase of the game where, again, it's all about what are the limits on communication. You know, we've talked about time, we talked about physical distance being a limited communication. What about things like language? What about things like time zones, for instance? All right, so any of the games that you're making cooperative games, I think they're all competitive in a way.
Ours is semi-cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
The end goal is, would you say competitive, Matt? I mean,
yeah-ish.
In the end, it's like a competitive thing, but to achieve the most you can, it'll be cooperative.
Okay, is this the base climbing one? No,
is this
the Everest climbing one?
No.
I was going to say, we're definitely cooperative, but two teams, I guess.
Two versus one.
Yeah.
Oh, it's two competitive teams.
Yeah.
So you have cooperation within the team and competition between teams. And which game was the one that
the ship captain?
Yeah.
The ship captain one, right. Because they're trying to be able to put all this information together, right? So is there anything from Matt's presentation that you might want to try out in the game?
I really like his idea of just like small leveling, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
So he said he had three. He gave a flowchart, which I really liked.
Right.
So you want to make it balanced between player skill and game difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's too much game difficulty and too little player skill, you have anxiety. And if there's too much player skill and too little game difficulty, you have boredom. So he has like a basic version that he suggests you start with. And then if you're a really good gamer, you might move on to the normal version or then the advanced version really quickly. And at first I was like, oh, that's really complicated, right? Three versions of the game. But then he explains that he did it, and he just adds one card to the deck.
Yeah.
And that's how he changed the difficulty.
Yeah. And there's another game. In Forbidden Island, I believe the only change in difficulty is that you start... the way how Forbidden Island works is that you are on an island that's slowly sinking into the water. And there's a water level marker. So at a difficulty, by increasing difficulty, you just start at a higher level of water, and more stuff is submerged at the beginning of the game. But the rules don't change. And if you're going to try to do something like that in your game, I would certainly encourage you to think of difficulty level in that way. Don't give us, like, here are the simple set of rules for simple players, and the advanced set of rules for advanced players. Don't do that. Change things like just the starting conditions, so that I wouldn't encourage you to change like individual variables in your game, because that might be too complicated to get across. But things like setup, that's okay. Once you've got the whole game set up at the correct difficulty level, you don't have to worry about the differences between setup for easy or setup for hard. Giving people extra options, for instance, by giving them different extra cards and stuff like that, could also be a good way to be able to just consistently change the level of difficulty throughout the game. That's a good idea. He Is that, besides the stuff that he was talking about, cooperative and competitive, he just talks about what it was like to design his first board game. You know, I believe he stated that was his first board game. Definitely his first published board game, which was
Pandemic. Fish and Chips.
Oh yeah, all right, Fish and Chips, that's right.
Oh wait, I just got that joke, wow.
anyone observing or hear anything interesting from that one? From the stuff he was talking outside of the cooperative and competitive, about cooperative game design?
Did you mean just something interesting about that talk?
Yeah, anything else that was interesting? Because I've been asking you questions specifically on his thoughts on cooperative game design, right? But that's all. But you know, that's only part of his talk. That's not his whole talk. So I'm wondering if anyone noticed anything interesting.
I think he said he mentioned Ameritrash and then this Euro game.
Ah, yeah.
Something I had to look up. And then when I looked online, it seemed to be either something that had faded out, sort of.
It's one of those almost invented internet forum arguments, I guess. But it's one that I mean, it's like ludology and narratology in game design. It's like that's another one where, like, that's the sort of thing that you say now just to make people roll their eyes at you. But back in the 90s, I guess, it was the biggest thing. It was like, are games about the systems or are games about the stories? You know, the whole thing was just that. And it were people, you know, sort of arguing past each other, not actually wanting to talk to each other, just wanting to shout at each other about that. And Marine Trash and Eurogames are one of those things. Clearly, from the description of Marine Trash, you can sort of expect that the people who like Eurogames gave it that turn, right?
An aesthetic argument.
Yeah.
The Ameritrash games were, the big problems with the Ameritrash games were the Milton Bradley Game Makers games. I think they were called Game Makers or Game Masters series in the mid-80s, like Axis and Allies. There's another Empire one, but games with a board with lots of little plastic pieces, where there's just a lot of like detail given to the injection molding on the pieces rather than the system. Like that's where it was thought the money was spent. Whereas a Euro game is, well, it's little wooden cubes, not much theme going on, and so the system has more overfill, more of the amount of attention and detail put on it.
There is a lower cost version that is along those same lines. The Ameritrash is a lot about presentation, right?
Yeah.
A lot of, I'm trying to think, Munchkin? Anyone play Munchkin? Yeah, okay. So, you know, this card game about sort of dungeon crawling, being really bad role-playing gamers. And it's all about the art, it's all about the funny text that they've written. It's not necessarily about cool-looking pieces, but it's about cool-looking cards that you can laugh with, you know, while you're playing the game. But the game system itself, it's kind of messy, actually, and not that interesting. Yeah.
I might call Magic
Ameritrash. And Magic the Gathering sort of trades on the same sort of thing. It's like, we're just going to layer complexity on top of complexity and complexity. There is very little elegance in the system, right? Of course, every once in a while they strip it out and then it comes to a pretty elegant system and then they keep adding stuff on top of everything. That's because that's how the business model works. Yeah.
So, I guess, like, my big question about that is, how is Ameritrash different from the theme games like Monopoly and stuff?
Not that different. It is a more derogatory term, but I think when it comes to stuff that's really old, like Monopoly, there is still there's a limited level of presentation they could possibly achieve with, you know, traditional manufacturing. And by the time these terms in Ameritrash had showed up, games like Monopoly and Clue and all that had already been shrunk down into budget versions, right? And it was like you're no longer getting metal pieces; you're getting like little plastic pieces that barely look like the dog or the hat that they're supposed to be. games like Battleship, where it's like the whole idea is that it's not really like the Battleship kit looks nice. It's just that it's small, portable, and easy to manufacture, and that people grew up in Battleship. And those games are being sold on a completely different premise, because those games are primarily nostalgia games. Those games are games that you bought because you played them at one point in time. But I think Ameritrash was mostly used to brand a certain kind of game that you'll be buying because you want to play for the first time. Like, you know, Munchkin that you buy for to play with a bunch of friends. Often published by companies that either had a wargaming background or a role-playing book kind of background, like Steve Jackson, for instance. Because they're used, I'm not so sure if this came up in class, but this is something that I remember hearing recently. The idea of the game writer, you know, what is something about people?
Mac was talking about writer versus inventor versus designer.
Right. So the idea that games were things that you would write comes out from the role playing game industry, where their primary product were books. And sure, the books included descriptions of systems, but if prose is your tool to be able to get things across, you're going to try to use prose for the things that prose is good at, or things like creating atmosphere by, you know, or setting, giving you exquisite detail about the setting of a world or characters and things like that. Whereas the Eurogames Eurogames were originally designed for quite a different market from the role-playing tradition. Role-playing games are designed for enthusiasts. Eurogames are designed for Christmas presents. Very specifically, they're designed to sell lots and lots and lots of copies in Christmas to families. So not only had the systems have to be simple enough for kids to be able to learn, but also advanced enough for the adults to be able to want to play them and give them away as gifts to other people. And so there's a lot of attention paid to like simple rules, very, very complex interactions. And I don't know what's the push towards the simplicity of pieces, sort of the abstraction of like cubes and circles and maybe cobblestone, like the meeples are like as elegant.
A lot of it's just due to the factory. Ludofact is the one factory that makes it all.
Really? One?
There's one factory in Germany that makes most of them, or made most of them.
Okay.
They don't make them in China, those games.
Okay, that's economy of scale there, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like cubes are easier to make than anything else.
So when it comes, like you said, your games are like for families and like Christmas presents and stuff.
Yeah.
That feels kind of weird to me because I would expect like for children to care a lot about the presentation of a game.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you reconcile that, I guess?
I don't know much about the social dynamics of the European family. Who makes the call of what game they're gonna play, right? Is it the kids or is it the parents? I certainly grew up in a family where the parents would say, this is what we're playing now. We are playing Scrabble because mom likes Scrabble and mom will destroy all of us at Scrabble. try it. So I don't know if that's the same thing in European families.
We had a professor come in who talked about this a couple of years ago. One thing that happens, at least in Germany, is there is a conference called Essen Toy Fair?
I guess a convention. Trade Fair.
Trade Fair.
Right word, yeah.
The Essen Fair happens in Essen in Germany. Thousands upon thousands of people in Germany go to that fair to play the new games before they're published. And then the result of the fair is they give the Spiel the ARS Award, the Game of the Year Award, which then, if you get that award, they'll sell them 50,000 to 100,000.
Because every newspaper will cover it.
All the newspapers are going to cover it. But like those families are going to go there, play those games, the kids are going to be interested in those games, then when Christmas time comes around, the game they get is going to be the game that won the Spiel the ARS Award, not necessarily the games they played at the convention. Because that's the game that got the award, so everybody bought it that year, and the next year at the flea markets, that game is all over the place being resold. It's a very different kind of consumption economy going on over there. You get like here it's a hobbyist market. And here it's being sold in hobby stores. It's not necessarily family oriented at all. Or if it's family oriented, it's a particular kind of family orientation.
So there are like toy fairs in the U.S. then, like Tickle Me Elmo and Furby.
Yeah, the toy fairs are, yeah, they're in the U.S. They're inventors, products from China, and again, one thing gets bought, and one thing gets sold, and everybody wants that one thing every single year.
But the majority of people who go to Essen are, in fact, families, tourists, you know, but a lot of them are from like tourists from other parts of Germany going to Essen, but also from Europe as a whole. But of course, that's a small number of people who are going to Essen who are the distributors, the people who are going to decide what to put on store shelves. And they're looking at the families. They're trying to figure out what is going to be that hot product, you know, this year so that they can get their orders in.
What time of year is it?
I think it's August.
Yeah, it's summer. It's like,
okay. So I give
right
enough time
Christmas.
To build up. Yeah.
So, but I don't know the extent to which the manufacturers need to have lined up their pipelines before Essen in order to be able to capitalize on the Spielberg Gyrus award.
Yeah.
Because if you fail to miss your window, if you get the award and you can't actually put enough product out there, then you just, you know, you put it. You can't make as much money as you could.
And the toy fairs in the U.S., are they mainly consumers going to it, or is it
industry
professionals and they're sort of like rubbing shoulders? Yeah.
Press go to toy fairs as well.
Yeah, it's press, industry, it's Walmart, basically these days. It's Walmart and a couple other.
So it's like you're an inventor, you're trying to get on Walmart shelves, so that's why you'd go.
Yeah,
you're trying to find like the next hot toy for Christmas.
Well, I'm not so sure if the toy fairs in the U.S. are that inventor friendly.
The inventors have already gotten picked up by somebody, so it's a publisher, it's a maker who has already a stable of inventors that they purchased product from.
So they're taking
it to this place to test it out to see if the
who are they testing it on?
The press and the people who are going to sell it.
Isn't it backwards though? Because it's the consumer that's going to be buying it, not the press.
The consumer doesn't have a need for it until they find out about it, though. It's a very different process. The consumer, like when you look at toys, you just look at the U.S. toy industry. The consumer just isn't involved.
It's
the
just whatever the hype machine builds up.
Yeah.
Yep.
Whichever hype machine has the most money behind it gets the product on the shelves. And these days, it's transmedia properties, or not media, maybe not transmedia, but like multimedia properties. There's the game, the toy, the cartoon. Comic, everything around it.
Like a multi-platform kind of.
Yeah.
Thing. Yeah. I mean, because you have multiple advertising campaigns pushing each one of those threads, but they're also sort of pushing the entire way forward.
If this is something of interest to you, go to a Walgreens or a CVS, go to the toy area, and look at the toys that have really poorly designed games on the back of them. Just to kind of see, like, these are the things that kind of got... Somebody made it, it didn't get much press, didn't get that hype machine behind it, and just see the level of what kind of quality was, what is the effort they put into that thing. And for the most part, it's just the packaging. The actual thing that's inside is that.
I'm trying to think. Where's the big toy fair in the U.S.? Is it New York?
It's in New York. Yeah.
New York, right.
Yeah.
Do you know when it is-ish? Is it summer as well?
I want to say summer, because I helped Toys R Us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I helped... one of Toys R Us vendors do a display for Lego for a toy fair.
Okay,
I want to say it's summer, but I can be wrong.
Do you ever see families there?
I didn't actually go. I just shipped the product.
Oh, okay. So my sensation is that you don't really see families there.
No.
You may see adult enthusiasts.
Yeah.
Collectors in particular. My
customer was like they made point of purchase displays.
What?
They made point of purchase displays for like retail outlets,
mm-hmm.
and it was like a huge deal.
Okay, yeah. So this is where they're selling things to stores to sell things,
yeah.
not the actual product that the stores are actually selling. Sure, that makes sense.
February. Like
February?
Jeez. Toy Fair, New York, 2015, February 14th to the 7th.
Oh, good lord. Okay, February. Okay. I have a lot more to learn about toy industry.
So I guess it's Valentine's Day, House of Cards, and toys.
The other thing that I thought was actually kind of interesting in the video was how he was talking with the folks with Days at Wonder, and he was describing about embodying the player, giving the player something that they can identify with, either on the board or, if all else fails, somewhere on the packaging. Something that you can project yourself into. I'm not entirely sure if that is sort of universally accepted across all publishers or even conventional wisdom across the board game industry. But it's certainly interesting to see it from the point of view of one publisher saying this is something important about the games that we want to publish. And we've got a little bit of this from the talks from the Game Makers Guild the other day. But if you're going to attempt to go to a publisher and try to say this is a game that you should be interested in, definitely try to do some research on not just how the kinds of games that they make, but also how they present those games to people, right? You know, you can probably make a good game, and the people who run those companies have seen enough good games to be able to see past any things you may have missed. But it might improve your pitch a little bit and say, like, we've taken into account that you like, you know, or I've taken into account that you like to position your games, to present your games in a certain way, and this is how you could do it with the game that I'm pitching to you, even though what I'm showing right now is a prototype that doesn't have that. Just being able to speak to that means that you're at least you're aware of the company's strategy and how they like to sell things. So, you know, if you're talking to a publisher, which generally does transmedia tie-ins, right? You know, who I don't know who publishes Twilight Prison, Twilight Trivial Pursuit, but someone does because I saw it on sale. But to say that, you know, this particular set of game mechanics will be a great tie-in for this particular property or something that you already have. Even though that may not be something that they want to do, it's probably good for a publisher to be able to realize that you understand their business, at least a particular section of the business that they're in.
Well, it's also some publishers, Fantasy Flight doesn't want you to have IP attached to your game. They're going to bring their IP to the game. So they want mechanics, they want rules, they want how it's going to play, but they don't care about the space travel game, because you might sell it to them and they say, all right, it's now a fantasy game, because it's the IP that we're working with this year.
Also probably gives you an idea of the kind of deal and contract that you can get out of them, right? Because if you say you want to retain absolute creative control on it and determine, you know, the art that's going to go on the box or something like that, you might not even be able to get that contract from someone like Fantasy Flight. Yeah. Whereas it's something that might be negotiable for.
Well, like Game Salute in New Hampshire is there. You would talk to them about what Kickstarter campaign you're going to run, because that's what they're going to do, is do a Kickstarter campaign with the game that, they're publishing with you.
So in other words, before you go and do a pitch on the publisher, just, you know, don't go in with like a generic pitch. Of course, if you're going to something like a toy, like a convention, you know, there are game inventors that things like PAX, for instance. Boston Festival of Indie Games is one that's going to be right here on campus. If you've got a prototype that you want to let people know about, and maybe, I guess you don't get many publishers here, but you might get.
That's probably going to change.
Yeah. Gathering of Friends is one such group where you have inventors and publishers all sitting at the same table. You don't need to prepare something special for publishers when you go to something like that, because they're showing it to multiple publishers at once. But if you're actually going to submit it to Hasbro or something like that, you know, you might just want to say this, you know, this might make a great make a great Transformers game. It might because parts connect to each other, or, you know, objects change in mode or something like that. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say about that. Okay. So today's supposed to be playtest day. It's almost 2. We have all our parts up here. So how about we start playtest at 3 o'clock? That should probably give you enough time to be able to get something playable by then, I'm hoping. Figure out what you want to test, how you're going to present it to people, and what questions you need answered through the playtest. Cool. Right.